Radio Borders Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. We will continue listening to Tenjin's previous program with the book Mind Trainings Like the Rays of Sun by Lam Kapow. And please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome. Trungpa Toku Karma Lodro Lung Rik Mawe Sangye Rinpoche is the ninth reincarnation of the Trungpa lineage and the most prominent Lama of the Kagyu tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. He says this about consistency. Consistency is usually a good quality. It describes someone who has a good character continuously and is not flaky. Someone who still has integrity through many years and a noble heart. And this is how we usually view consistency, isn't it? As a good thing. Even though Aldous Huxley said that the only really consistent people are the dead, and Ralph Waldo Emerson defined what he called foolish consistency as the hobgoblin of little minds, adored by little statesmen and philosophers and divines. Oh, but by divines, I guess he means religious people, perhaps like myself. He says a great soul will speak what he thinks now in hard words, and tomorrow again speaks in hard words what he thinks, even though it may totally contradict what he said today. And to the objection that such a person would surely be misunderstood, he said, is it so bad then to be misunderstood? Pythagoras was misunderstood, and Socrates and Jesus, and Luther and Copernicus, and Galileo and Newton, and every pure and wise spirit that ever took flesh. To be great is to be misunderstood. Now, I'm not quite convinced by this argument, but I guess Emerson was a fan of crazy wisdom. And it's certainly true that the Buddha did not always teach the same thing from one day to another. It is said that he taught according to the disposition and wisdom of those in front of him. And, of course, each person of the multitudes that went to hear him had a different disposition. And that is why his teachings can appear to us to be inconsistent. To one he might teach one thing, while to another the exact opposite. But this type of consistency is not what we were discussing in our last program. If you were with us, you may remember that we were talking about the mind training slogan, Do Not Be Consistent, which Trungpa Rinpoche translates as, Don't Be So Constant. Alan Wallace went even more obtuse with, Do Not Devote Yourself to the Central Object. But however you like to word it, it means don't be so consistent in always following your natural instincts. Trungpa Rinpoche tells it like this. In our life, we are quite consistent in our actions. If someone is very good to us, we're kind in return. Whereas if someone harms us, then we try to take revenge. This is what consistency means here. The instruction is suggesting that we act in the opposite way from a worldly person. If somebody harms us, we need to respond with kindness, not to exact revenge. We seek to benefit them, not to harm them. It has to do with how we usually are. Should we continue sticking to the way we usually are, to the tendency to be selfish and to regard ourselves as really important? No, that is not necessary, which is what is meant in this verse. With his explanation of the slogan, Galwa Gendan Drupa, another Tibetan teacher, follows the abstruse school with avoid yet practice getting tough, and then explains there's no need to get tough with humans or non-humans. In fact, to do so is harmful to us both conventionally and spiritually. With what should we get tough? With the self-cherishing attitude, which is the root of all our suffering. We should make this the target of our every spiritual endeavor. It is, of course, the self-cherishing attitude that is behind all our afflictive emotions. So he's saying more or less the same as Trungpa Rinpoche. As Geshe's Robton and Dagi wrote in their book, Advice from a Spiritual Friend, it is entirely due to our indulgence in the afflictions of greed, aggression, and ignorance that we may remain caught in the net of confusion. Hereafter, we must stop being gentle with these true enemies and instead be gentle with other sentient beings. So all the commentaries emphasize that this verse advises us not to be consistent as we usually are in yielding to our afflictive emotions, but instead, as spiritual practitioners, to turn away from them and be kind and gentle with other beings. Now, for those who forgot or have only just joined the program, the slogan we're talking about comes from Namkar Pel's Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, a commentary on another quite famous text, The Seven Points of Mind Training. Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun is a mind training text we've been examining for the last 110 programs, which in terms of time spent on one Tibetan teaching text might be some kind of a record. But anyway, before we go further with Namkar Pal's commentary, let's consider motivation as usual and set a bodhicitta motivation for the program to attain enlightenment to best benefit all other beings. How many other beings are there? Infinite. Did you know that insects, and this is only insects and none of the other beings on this planet, outnumber humans some 200 million to one, according to Iowa State University entomologists Larry Pedigo and Marlon Rice in their newly published textbook, Entomology and Pest Management. Krill alone number an estimated 500 million individuals. So imagine really experientially understanding that all these and countless other beings are exactly the same as you in wanting happiness and not wanting any suffering. Wouldn't you have a strong desire to help them all and not to cause them any suffering at all? And would it not be wonderful if you could completely relieve all of their suffering in such a way that it could never ever return? Now wouldn't that be amazing? So that is what we are directing our energy towards today. And the teachings say that by doing this, we can amass a very great amount of positive potential that will help us travel further on the spiritual path. It's a win-win situation. Others benefit from our beneficial intentions, and we benefit by developing this great positive potential, which, of course, we immediately give away to benefit others. And that brings more positive potential, which we give away again. And so it goes on. So now let's take a moment to look into our intention and see why we are participating in the program today. And if we find some much smaller motivation, like wanting a quiet, happy mind just for ourselves, let's transform it into this so much greater intention. Thank you. Now I must return to a theme I've talked about many times before. The Tibetans in their teachings at least give this impression of being almost gladiatorial with the afflictive emotions, and I guess to people with a kind of combative nature that is natural. However, not all of us enjoy the rough and tumble antagonism of someone out to prove something to himself and others. Some do find a more gentle approach helps them not to vanquish, but to transform even the afflictive emotions. For all that Trungpa Rinpoche, Geshe's Robton and Dagi say, if we see afflictive emotions as the enemy, then we will likely treat them as an enemy and stand up to them with fists raised. If you've ever seen a boxing match, you will know what happens to both boxers by the end of the fight, no matter who wins or loses. Teachers like Thich Nhat Hanh, Ram Dass, and Pema Chodron take an almost opposite approach. They see difficult emotions as our friends and teachers. These emotions are, in fact, our path to enlightenment. For instance, ineed.motivation.com has 10 verses from Thich Nhat Hanh's book, Taming the Tiger Within, that in a way encapsulates his attitude to the negative emotions. This is how they go. When you say something unkind, when you do something in retaliation, your anger increases. You make the other person suffer, and they try hard to say or do something back to make you suffer and get relief from their suffering. That is how conflict escalates. Just like our organs, our anger is part of us. When we're angry, we have to go back to ourselves and take good care of our anger. We cannot say, go away, anger, I don't want you. When you have a stomach ache, you don't say, I don't want you, stomach, go away. No, you take care of it. In the same way, we have to embrace and take good care of our anger. Just because anger or hate is present does not mean that the capacity to love and accept is not there. Love is always with you. When you are angry and you suffer, please go back and inspect very deeply the content, the nature of your perceptions. If you are capable of removing the wrong perception, peace and happiness will be restored to you, and you will be able to love the other person again. When you get angry with someone, please don't pretend that you're not angry. Don't pretend that you don't suffer. If the other person is dear to you, then you have to confess that you're angry and that you suffer. Tell him or her in a calm, loving way. In the beginning, you may not understand the nature of your anger or why it has come to be. But if you know how to embrace it with the energy of mindfulness, it will become clear to you. Anger is like a howling baby, suffering and crying. Your anger is your baby. The baby needs his mother to embrace him. You are the mother. Embrace your baby. Anger has roots in non-anger elements. It has roots in the way we live our daily life. If we take good care of everything in us without discrimination, we prevent our negative energies from dominating. We reduce the strength of our negative seeds so that they won't overwhelm us. In a time of anger or despair, even if we feel overwhelmed, our love is still there. Our capacity to communicate, to forgive, to be compassionate is still there. You have to believe this. We are more than our anger. We are more than our suffering. We must recognize that we do have within us the capacity to love, to understand, to be compassionate, always. When we embrace anger and take good care of our anger, we obtain relief. We can look deeply into it and gain many insights. One of the first insights may be that the seed of anger in us has grown too big and is the main cause of our misery. As we begin to see this reality, we realize that the other person whom our anger is directed at is only a secondary cause. The other person is not the real cause of our anger. And that's Thich Nhat Hanh. Do you notice how non-combative Thich Nhat Hanh is to anger? He does not raise his fists to it, trying to use the very weapons of anger against anger. As the Buddha himself said, hatred is never appeased by hatred in this world. By non-hatred alone is hatred appeased. This is a law eternal. Even against hatred, you cannot use the weapons of hatred. Doesn't hating hatred just cause a war inside you? As Thich Nhat Hanh says, in a time of anger or despair, even if we feel overwhelmed, our love is still there. Our capacity to communicate, to forgive, to be compassionate is still there. You have to believe this. We are more than our anger. We are more than our suffering. We must recognize that we do have within us the capacity to love, to understand, to be compassionate always. And anger can be our guide to enlightenment. When we embrace anger and take good care of our anger, we obtain relief. We can look deeply into it and gain many insights, he says. The person we are angry with is not the cause of our anger. If we look closely enough, we will see this clearly, and we can start to see what the real cause of our anger and misery is. Of course, we are taught that the real cause of anger is the self-grasping and self-cherishing attitude, but we can only truly realize this from within anger itself. If we can deal with the energy of anger in a sane way, we can get profound insight from it. In her book, The Places That Scare You, A Guide to Fearlessness in Difficult Times, Pema Chodron suggests four methods for dealing sanely with troublesome emotions when they threaten to engulf us. This is what she writes. The most straightforward advice on awakening enlightened mind is this: practice not causing harm to anyone, yourself or others, and every day do what you can to be helpful. If we take this instruction to heart and begin to use it, we will probably find that it's not so easy. Before we know it, someone has provoked us, and either directly or indirectly, we've caused harm. Therefore, when our intention is sincere, but the going gets rough. Most of us could use some help. We could use some fundamental instruction on how to lighten up and turn around our well-established habits of striking out and blaming. The four methods for holding our seat provide just such support for developing the patience to stay open to what's happening instead of acting on automatic pilot. These four methods are not setting up the target for the arrow, connecting with the heart, seeing obstacles as teachers, and regarding all that occurs as a dream. First, if we've not set up the target, it cannot be hit by an arrow. This is to say that each time we retaliate with aggressive words and actions, we are strengthening the habit of anger. As long as we do this, without doubt, plenty of arrows will come our way. We will become increasingly irritated by the reactions of others. However, each time we are provoked, we're given the chance to do something different. We can strengthen old habits by setting up the target, or we can weaken them by holding our seat. Each time we sit still with the restlessness and heat of anger, we are tamed and strengthened. This is instruction on cultivating the root of happiness. Each time we act on the anger or suppress it, we escalate our aggression. We become more and more like a walking target. Then, as the years go by, almost everything makes us mad. This is the key to understanding, at a completely real and personal level, how we sow the seeds of suffering. So this is the first method. Remember that we set up the target and only we can take it down. Understand that if we hold our seat when we want to retaliate, even if it's only briefly, we are starting to dissolve a pattern of aggression that will continue to hurt us and others forever if we let it. Second is the instruction for connecting with the heart. In times of anger, we can contact the kindness and compassion that we already have. When someone who is confused or distressed starts to harm us, we can easily understand that she doesn't know what she's doing. There is the possibility of contacting our heart and feeling sadness that she's out of control and is harming herself by hurting others. There is the possibility that even though we feel fear, we do not feel hatred or anger. Instead, we might feel inspired to help this person if we can. Actually, a person in distress is far more rational than a grounded person who harms us, for that so-called sane person has the potential to realize that in acting aggressively, he's sowing seeds of his own confusion and dissatisfaction. His present aggression is strengthening future, more intense habits of aggression. He's creating his own soap opera. This kind of life is painful and lonely. The one who harms us is under the influence of patterns that could continue to produce suffering forever. So this is the second method. Connect with the heart. Remember that the one who harms us does not need to be provoked further, and neither do we. Recognize that just like us, millions are burning with the fire of aggression. We can sit with the intensity of the anger and let its energy humble us and make us more compassionate. The third is the instruction on seeing difficulties as teachers. If there's no other teacher around to give us direct personal guidance on how to stop causing harm, never fear. Life itself will provide opportunities for learning how to hold our seat. Without the inconsiderate neighbor, where will we find the chance to practice patience? Without the office bully, how could we ever get the chance to know the energy of anger so intimately that it loses its destructive power? The teacher is always with us. The teacher is always showing us precisely where we're at, encouraging us not to speak and act in the same old neurotic ways, encouraging us not to repress or dissociate, encouraging us not to sow the seeds of suffering. So, with this person who is scaring us or insulting us, do we retaliate as we have 100,000 times before? Or do we start to get smart and finally hold our seat? Right at the point when we are about to blow our top or withdraw into oblivion, we can remember this. We are warriors in training, being taught how to sit with edginess and discomfort. We are being challenged to remain and to relax where we are. She goes on to say that the problem with following these or any instructions is that we have a tendency to be too serious and rigid. She says we get tense and uptight about trying to relax and be patient. And she continues, this is where the fourth instruction comes in. It is helpful to think about the person who is angry, the anger itself, and the object of that anger as being like a dream. We can regard our life as a movie in which we are temporarily the leading player. Rather than making it so important, we can reflect on the essencelessness of our current situation. We can slow down and ask ourselves, who is this monolithic me that has been so offended? And who is this other person who can trigger me like this? What is this praise and blame that hooks me like a fish, that catches me like a mouse in a trap? How is it that these circumstances have the power to propel me like a ping-pong ball from hope to fear, from happiness to misery? This big deal struggle, this big deal self, and this big deal other could all be lightened up considerably. Contemplate these outer circumstances as well as these emotions, as well as this huge sense of me, as passing and essenceless, like a memory, like a movie, like a dream. When we awaken from sleep, we know that the enemies in our dreams are an illusion. That realization cuts through panic and fear. When we find ourselves captured by aggression, we can remember this. There is no basis for striking out or for repressing. There is no basis for hatred or shame. We can at least begin to question our assumptions. Could it be that whether we are awake or asleep, we are simply moving from one dreamlike state to another? These four methods for turning anger around and for learning a little patience come to us from the Kadampa masters of the 11th century Tibet. These instructions have provided encouragement for fledgling bodhisattvas in the past, and they are just as useful in the present. These same Kadampa masters advised that we not procrastinate. They urged us to use these instructions immediately, on this very day, in this very situation, and not to say to ourselves, I will try this in the future when I have a bit more time. That is Pema Chodron. So if that comes from the Tibetan masters, maybe they're not so combative after all. Maybe they talk like fist fighters, but act like magicians. But if I were to ask you whether working even with Pema Chodron's four methods come easily, I think the answer would be a definite no. Who, in the middle of a bout of anger, can stop and say, never mind, it's all a dream? It's not so easy. In a blog on the Huffington Post, Ram Dass writes on how to develop mindfulness in the midst of anger and the sense of righteousness that comes with it. He writes, so it turns out there's no rule book to take with you in life that says, when I get into this condition, do this. My rule is actually really quite simple. I continually work to quiet my mind to stay mindful. I continue to work to soften my heart to stay heartfelt. I work as well as I can to keep the energies flowing in my system. I mean, this is energy. I'm constantly opening and watching and listening and tuning. I'm listening my way into the universe. I'm hearing my way. I'm hearing my way, not listening actually. You can feel that when you really listen, you almost start to dissolve into the other person's storyline. You can feel that when you really listen, you tune your way into the universe, and when the fear arises, you sit with it. I sit with it, and I don't push it away. I don't grab at it. I know what my limits are, and I often say, I can't handle that one just yet, and I don't end up feeling guilty about it. I stopped holding myself to a standard of where I should be as a means of beating myself up when I'm not there. Don't turn the spiritual journey into another psychological thing to prove you're a victim or you are somehow inadequate or impotent or incompetent or something. You can do it if you want to, but it's really not that much fun to go about it that way. You want to go from using the spiritual journey in the service of your psychodynamics, in the service of your ego, to using your psychodynamics in the service of the spiritual thing. In other words, I can use my anger to liberate me now, when before I used my righteous desire to show how good I was, which was an ego trip, and in answer to the question, who am I? My usual answer now is that I really don't know. I don't know. And it's interesting that that part of me that wants to know also just doesn't really care now. I don't know why, but all I know is at this moment, this feels fine. However, if this were 2 a.m, it probably wouldn't be. I may be sitting here alone, talking to myself, and maybe someone would come along. It would be a new moment, a special moment, and maybe I'd keep talking, maybe we would start a conversation that would change how I feel. I don't know. But at some moment, a set of events will transpire, and this feeling will stop, and then I will come back to it again. So I think from a political, social point of view, what you find is that in every walk of life, there are people who recognize the predicament. And that's what you really end up doing, is hanging out with people who recognize the predicament. And then you do what you can do. Ram Dass also tells this provocative story about his teacher, Neem Karoli Baba, a.k.a. Maharaji. A young fellow once came and Maharaji asked him how he was. And he said, "Oh, Maharaji, I've overcome anger." Maharaji said, "Oh, very good," and kept praising him. At the time, there was another fellow present who had been asking Maharaji for years to come to his house. But Maharaji had never come because the boy's father didn't believe in sadhus or saints. But now, Maharaji turned to this boy and said, "Do you still want me to come to your house?" The boy said, "Yes, but let me arrange it with my father." Maharaji said, "Go, and then we will all come." The visit would mean, of course, that the place of honor in the house would be given to Maharaji, so the father would have to sit someplace else. Finally, the whole party went and Maharaji sat on the tucket belonging to the boy's father. Then Maharaji leaned over and looked the father in the eye and said, "Oh, you're a great saint." But in Hindi, he used the very personal form, which you use only with very intimate friends and to people in the lower caste. So it was really an insult to use that form to the old father. The old man got upset, but held himself together. A little time passed, and Maharaji leaned over again and said, "You're a great saint." By this time, the father's face got red, and he was getting worked up, but he still kept control. A few minutes more went by, and Maharaji leaned over and said the same thing again. This time, the father completely lost it. He got up and started screaming at Maharaji, "You're no saint. You just come in and eat people's food. You take their beds, and you're a phony." At this point, the young fellow who had overcome anger leapt to his feet, grabbed the father by the collar, and started shaking him, saying, "Shut up. You don't know who you're talking to. He's a great saint, and if you don't shut up, I'll kill you." At this point, Maharaji got up, looked around bewildered, and said, "What's the matter? What's the matter? Don't they want me to be here?" "Oh, we should go. They don't want me here." So he got up and started walking out. And he turned to the young fellow as he was going out and said, "It's very difficult to overcome anger. Some of the greatest saints don't overcome anger." The fellow said, "But Maharaji, he was abusing you." "That's right. He was abusing me. Why were you angry?" And for homework, that is our story to ponder on for the next week. Now our time is up. Thanks for joining the program. I hope you've got something out of it and will tune in again next time. Please dedicate all the positive potential we've gathered to gaining enlightenment to benefit all beings. Thank you and goodbye.